From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The playwright Arthur Miller saw Tennessee Williams play A Streetcar Named Desire before it opened on Broadway, saw it in a theater in Connecticut, and he says it only took him a few minutes to realize the production had thrown open the doors to another theater world. It was Tennessee Williams' writing, he says, that made it different. And then there was Marlon Brando, who plays the role of Stanley Kowalski, brooding and sexual and violent. Miller described him as a tiger on the loose. NPR arts critic Bob Mondello says Brando's performance rewrote the book on American acting. Today in the program, we're talking about A Streetcar Named Desire. This is the 70th anniversary of the play. There's a production of it opening this week in Salt Lake City, which gives us an opportunity to talk about Tennessee Williams, Stanley, Stella, and Blanche, of course. Join us after the news.
Hey, it's Tim Slover from KUER. You like podcasts, right? I do. So this month, we're asking you to tell someone about a podcast you think they'll love. That could be your mom or a friend or, I don't know, someone who doesn't really get podcasts yet. Anybody. You can pick whatever podcast you want. Maybe it's about music or politics, maybe cooking or Stranger Things fan theories or rodeo clowning or meditation. Just get a friend to listen. Remember to hit the share button and use the hashtag tripod. That's try with a Y followed by pod because of jokes. And thanks for getting the word out.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You've got a feel for anyone who tries to stage a play that has become an icon. Let's be honest, when most people think of Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire, they think of Marlon Brando as Stanley. They think of Vivian Leigh as Blanche. The kindness of strangers, Brando moaning Stella's name. If you're a director or an actor, how do you make people forget about those moments? Well, NPR arts critic Bob Mondello has seen good productions of Streetcar and maybe not so good productions, but he says he's glad people keep interpreting it for themselves. Otherwise, he says, the play would turn into a museum piece. The people with the Grand Theater in Salt Lake City are giving it a go. Their version of Streetcar Named Desire opens this weekend, which gives us a chance to talk about the play, the film of the play, the themes, the writing, the performances. Robert Bray is joining us today. He's a Tennessee Williams scholar, a professor of English at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the founding editor emeritus of the Tennessee Williams Annual Review. He's written a number of articles and chapters on Tennessee Williams, a lot here, in fact. He's joining us from public radio station WMOT in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Robert Bray, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you today.
I mentioned NPR's arts critic Bob Mondello. He's with us. He's also the film critic, of course. He also a longtime critic in Washington as well. Bob is joining us again from NPR in Washington. And Bob, welcome back to you.
Good to be here, as always.
A Streetcar Named Desire opens tonight at the Grand Theater in Salt Lake City. We'll give you a few more details about that as we go along. I guess I wanted to begin, Robert Bray, with you. Where does A Streetcar Named Desire fit, like situated in American theater?
Well, after 70 years, it's probably the one Williams play, along with The Glass Menagerie, that's become enshrined forever in the American psyche. It's traveled the long road, or streetcar tracks, if you will, from high art to popular culture, largely owing to the success of the 1951 film. It's really hard to overestimate the film's lasting legacy. But in terms of the play itself, I believe the reason it still resonates with us is because there are so many prisms through which we approach the play. It's psychologically complex. It's beautifully constructed. And it deals with issues as relevant today as they were 70 years ago.
In one of the published versions of the play, the playwright Arthur Miller wrote an introduction, which I read. And he talks about the first time seeing the play. Elia Kazan, the director, invited him to come see it before it had opened. This was in the Schubert Theater in New Haven. Anyway, it's really interesting to read Miller's very first impression of seeing that play. And he said that not long into the production itself, he realized that this was something different. And it wasn't the structure of the play, he said, that he noticed was different, but the writing. He described it as the lines as reading as a language flowing from the soul. Bob Mondello, Robert Bray, say something about that, just the significance of the writing, how that was important.
Well, I think it's true that the two of them, Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, write very differently. Yeah. Arthur Miller writes paragraphs, and he tends to. I mean, you get a sense that he knows exactly where things are going, and there's an order to it, and it's a very strong, muscular kind of writing. Tennessee Williams writes what I think of as poetry, and his characters tend to... I mean, some of his characters, especially the women, it's like clouds and shots of lightning and things like that. There is an imagery to Tennessee Williams that is not like anything that Arthur Miller would ever come up with.
Yes, I don't mean to dismiss Miller's playwriting, but he is rather prosaic when compared with Williams. The three greatest plays, in my humble opinion, in the American canon are Death of a Salesman, Streetcar, and Long Day's Journey into Night. And it's no accident that all of these plays deal with the American, with the family. And there's a universality there that keeps theater audiences coming back to these plays, because at some level everybody can identify with family struggle. And in Streetcar, it's how to get along with the in-laws.
I've never heard it described that way.
That's a very down-to-earth way of seeing that play. That's true.
But there is a lyricism there that that is just, some of Williams' females, especially the women, speak in it's almost like an aria that yeah. one's listening to.
Yeah.
So I couldn't agree more with Bob about that.
Maybe we should explain what this play is about. Robert Bray, you want to take a shot at this? I'm worried that we're talking about that for some they may not know, and you don't have to listen to this conversation and know what it's about. We'll give you a sense of it. I'm sure people have seen scenes from the film, but just give us the basic plot line, if you don't mind.
Well, the basic plot line is that Blanche DuBois is coming to stay with her sister and her brother-in-law. She has basically been run out of town in Laurel, Mississippi, and she is essentially homeless. The plantation has been lost, and she arrives at this rather squalid apartment in New Orleans, hoping to stay, hoping to get her footing. And the play is really about that adjustment that she's trying to make, coming from the plantation to this apartment that she can't believe her sister's living in, yeah. you know, and, yeah. and she throws that in her face and calls her husband all these names. And it's so hard to compress the plot.
That basically gets you there. And, you don't want to talk about too much about the ending of it anyway.
No.
But I think in real sense, what is really striking there is that Blanche almost always has a big floppy hat, is a elegant woman of the plantation. She has airs, and she comes in, and there's Stanley in a T-shirt.
Right.
And it's a different world. I mean, it's just and if it's Marlon Brando, there is a sort of an animal attraction there that is undeniable almost from the very moment she sees him. And it's a very striking piece of work. And Brando really was, and I think it's the terrible thing that you kind of have to live up to him in some way if you're playing Stanley. Brando really was a force of nature and was a complete surprise when this play opened. It was not his first play ever, but it was the first time anybody had noticed him. And, oh, my Lord, he changed the world.
It's interesting, and Robert Bray, talk a little bit more about this Marlon Brando coming onto the scene in this play. I'm not sure how Tennessee Williams thought about who was the central character, but Kazan thinks, the director, that it's probably Blanche. But then you have this powerful actor playing the role of Stanley, and I guess that's the mixed blessing that you write about. Maybe Stanley is the main character because the power of the actor Marlon Brando.
Brando was a commodity that was much sought after, not only by Kazan and Williams, who wanted him for virtually every project that they did together, but for everyone else as well. Unfortunately, there was only one Marlon Brando to go around, so he had to turn down a lot of these roles. But, yeah, I mean, he really sort of reinvents the idea of what American masculinity is. I mean, before Brando, we had Jimmy Stewart in a hat and suit.
Right.
And now we have Marlon Brando in a sweaty T-shirt who is all ripped. I mean, you know, most actors didn't go to the gym in those days. But Brando was just such an imposing physical presence. And it really became a problem during the Broadway production that ran for 2 years because, you know, the audience tended to side with Brando, and Kazan really worried that he, in his words, Streetcar was becoming the Marlon Brando show. And so when the film was produced, Kazan thought that he needed somebody to stand up to Stanley better, and so that's why they chose Vivian Leigh
over Jessica Tandy.
Over
and
Jessica
I always feel badly for Jessica Tandy. No one thinks about her as Blanche, and I'm wondering, what do you gentlemen know about her performance, her Blanche?
I was too young to see it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't born when this play opened on Broadway. But I think it's reasonable to assume that she was kind of spectacular. Certainly the reviews indicated she was wonderful. Robert, do you know more about that performance than I do?
There are a couple of small pieces of celluloid, but there's really not much, you know, to go on in mm-hmm. terms of actually seeing the performance. But, of course, it was recognized as a magnificent performance.
Yeah. She's a very strong actress,
amazing.
Certainly, and she certainly had a career after that. I'm not going to feel too terribly sorry
right.
for her.
Right, that's true.
But I thought it was. I think it's an interesting choice to choose Vivian Leigh, who is a very different sort of actor than Marlon Brando, to play opposite him. I mean, Brando, I'm on record as saying that he rewrote the books on American acting. What was out there before that was the Laurence Oliviers, the Humphrey Bogarts, the people who did a kind of acting that was that is more a little more artificial. It worked on screen, but it isn't the same. And you know, Americans had always had this sort of insecurity about our own homegrown actors, that British actors were the great ones, right? And the British ones were very high flown, and Oliviers and Gielgud and those folks were good examples of that. Brando mumbled. Brando shouted. Brando did all kinds of things that simply hadn't been done on stage and on screen. And he kind of changed everything. After that, everybody's trying to be him.
Yeah.
Yeah. When, of course, before she played Blanche in the film, she had been working as with Olivier, directing her as Blanche mm-hmm. in Streetcar in London. And this was a real problem when she came to Kazan's direction because, you know, Kazan would direct her in a certain way, and she said, "Oh, when Larry and I did it differently in London," and Kazan had to say, "You're not doing it in London anymore with Larry."
Yeah.
But Kazan is
and on Larry was her husband. Was he? Were they married
right.
at the time?
Yes,
yeah.
He was. And Kazan is on record as saying that he had to essentially kind of break her out of this artificial theatrical method of acting, mm-hmm. and it was a real problem at first. But after the first couple of weeks, I think that she sort of got into the flow.
Let me read something that Tennessee Williams writes in the production of the play about Stanley Kowalski. He writes, "Since earliest manhood, the center of his life has been pleasure with women, the giving and taking of it, not with weak indulgence dependently, but with the power and pride of a richly feathered male bird among hens," which I think is terrific. And it just lays out this sort of animal magnitude, animal joy, I think is how Tennessee Williams lays it out. Let me play a scene. This is from the film. Of course, this is Stanley and Blanche. Vivian Leigh, we mentioned. Marlon Brando, we mentioned. Stella, Kim Hunter. Another terrific performance. Doesn't quite have the same high profile, but there are moments when she's quite terrific. They're sitting around a dinner table. The ladies are telling jokes to distract from the fact that Blanche's date hasn't shown up. Blanche is sort of distracted by things, telling a joke, and here's this moment. It's kind of a visual scene, but you get a sense of what's happening.
I don't think Mr. Kowalski will be amused. Mr. Kowalski is too busy making a pig of himself to think of anything else. The face and your fingers are disgustingly greasy. Go wash up and then help me clear the table.
Now that's how I'm going to clear the table. Don't you ever talk that way to me. Pig, Polak, disgusting, vulgar, greasy. Those kind of words have been on your tongue and your sister's tongue is too much around here. Who do you think you are, a pair of queens? I just remember what Huey Long said, that every man's a king and I'm the king around here. And don't you forget it. My place is all cleared up now. You want me to clear yours?
That is a very radio scene,
by the way. Kind of is, right?
That was gorgeous.
I mean,
that was like a radio drama there.
It is, and it's so there's such a violence, and just there's something kind of it's really dark, and that sense of violence. I'm trying to figure out. Do you know how much of this is Brando deciding at the moment he's going to throw things? You know?
You mean just improvising?
Exactly.
I don't know. There is on the what was it? There's a DVD version of this that includes some outtakes.
Yeah.
And it has a sequence where he is improvising in the scene where he's shouting up the fire escape to Stella, and instead of yelling Stella, he yells something like "Honey."
Oh no, we've got it, Bob. We have it. In fact, let me play this for you because it doesn't have quite the same ring.
Action! Honey.
Yeah, that would not have played. And yet this is after he's done it on Broadway for years. It's not like he didn't remember the line.
I want to mention this too, because the way Williams describes this moment. Now, this is a moment after Stanley has beaten his wife, basically. She's retreated to the upstairs apartment in this house, and he's calling for her to come down. And as Williams writes, he says, the low tone clarinet moans. Ooh. The door upstairs opens again. They stare at this. Stella comes out, and we're going to play this moment because it's, of course, really iconic. And Williams writes in the play, they come together with low animal moans. He falls to his knees on the steps and presses his face into her belly. Robert Bray, Bob Mondello, I want to play this moment. Do you want to say something about this moment in the film? There's such a sensuality. I'm surprised they got away with that in 1951.
Well, a couple of things. One is some of Williams' best writing is his stage directions. And the other thing is that, when the Production Code Administration was dealing with all of the issues in this film, one of the things that they really objected to was the music. They thought that it depicted a carnality and a sexuality that just really was kind of over the top. But they weren't successful in getting the music out of the film. It was Alex North, of course.
Yeah.
Hey, Stella!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Joyce, I want my girls out here.
You shut up. You're going to get the law on you.
Stella!
You can't beat on a woman and then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, Joyce.
I hope they haul you in and turn a fire hose on you.
Joyce, I want my girls out here.
You stinker.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella! Mm-hmm.
Now we should say, so this is when Stella comes out and descends down the stairway. It's sexual. Robert Bray, right? I mean, it's really a sensual moment. That, and it's doesn't work on radio, obviously, but this idea of sexuality, that was remarkable for the time.
Absolutely. And we have a Tennessee Williams Festival every year in New Orleans, and the most popular part of the festival is called the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest, in which it's reenacted by contestants. And it's just great fun.
You know, it's funny. There are not a lot of I have used the Stella bit to as a joke in other things. When I was reviewing the Twilight movie Eclipse, and I said at one point that these two guys were posturing, and I made a big deal of the difference in the acting styles between the Wolf Boy and the Dracula type character, and I said, you almost expect him, the Wolf Boy, to yell Bella, and it was just a joke, but it was one that I knew the audience would get because it is such an iconic moment. And I'm there for it's funny how there aren't a lot of plays in the American canon that have lines that people know. I think in Shakespeare there are plenty, right? Everybody can do to be or not to be, and you know, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And you can do a lot of things from those. But from American plays, it's harder to find. I saw a production one time that was directed by a guy who was not from this country. He was from Eastern Europe. And he was encountering the play for the first time at Arena Stage and was doing a very strange production of it. Kind of a wonderful one, but it didn't get very well reviewed elsewhere, just by me. And one of the things that I heard later he had done, and the actor who was playing Mitch had said that this had happened, was that in rehearsal he'd been working on that last scene, and he said, "What is this kindness of strangers? We cut that." And the actors all said, "No, you can't cut that. That's the thing everybody knows." But this is a play that is you described it earlier as iconic. It is iconic. Yeah. There are characters here who are the American characters in a way, and there are lines here that people know, and I think that's remarkable. And that is not true. I mean, you know a couple of lines from Arthur Miller. Certainly, everybody knows "Attention Must Be Paid," but there aren't a lot. And Tennessee Williams had more than his share in this in Glass Menagerie.
Robert Bray, I wanted to ask you about Arthur Miller in that introduction he wrote to Streetcar, called Brando a tiger on the loose. Brando and Stanley, his character, a tiger on the loose, but also a sexual terrorist. We need to head to a break, but I want to have you talk a little bit about the clear sexual predation questions that come up. You know, the question of whether or not he's just this heartless sexual predator. Is he more complicated? We don't have a full backstory on Stanley, really. We don't know how wounded he might be as a person that might explain his, you know, his violence. I mean, what are people to make of Stanley?
Well, it's an interesting question. And when one reads the play, he does come across as all of these brutish things that you're saying. And after all, this is a man who abuses physically his wife while she's pregnant, rapes his wife's sister while his wife is in the hospital giving birth to his baby, and does all these terrible things. And yet it's the sexuality of the performance by Brando that just changes people's mind about how they conceive this character. I remember one time, after having taught the play, I showed it to my class, and I looked over, and there was one girl who just had her mouth open, and she was just having a hard time with the film. And I looked over to her, and I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I didn't know Stanley was going to be so good looking."
Wow.
So, you know, that it really does lend to a different interpretation of the material, his performance, Brando's performance.
Robert Bray is with us, co-author of the book Hollywood's Tennessee and founding editor emeritus of the Tennessee Williams Annual Review. Bob Mondello, of course, is the arts critic for NPR. Tonight at 7:30, the Grand Theater is premiering their production of A Streetcar Named Desire. The show runs through April 1st. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about one of the great classics of American theater, A Streetcar Named Desire. We found the perfect excuse to talk about it. There's a production of Streetcar opening this week. We'll give you details about that as we go along. We have with us Tennessee Williams scholar Robert Bray, and we have the NPR arts critic Bob Mondello with us this first part of the program, talking a little bit about A Streetcar Named Desire. We were talking just before the break about Stanley Kowalski, his character, what to make of him. Let's talk about Blanche DuBois. There was this letter, Robert Bray, you've written about this. There was this letter between Tennessee Williams and Elia Kazan, the director. And this exchange became a key to the production for Kazan. In the exchange, Tennessee Williams writes, "I remember you asked me what an audience should feel for Blanche. Certain pity. It is a tragedy with the classic aim of producing catharsis of pity and terror. But to do that, Blanche must finally have the understanding and compassion of the audience." So there's this question of always, I think, if you're an audience member, about is Blanche crazy? Is she malicious? Is she pathological? What do you make of the character of Blanche? Are we supposed to be wondering about all of those things?
Well, she's a psychologically complex character. There are no easy answers here. She's lost her husband to suicide. Her personality is disintegrating owing to drink and the circumstances in which she finds herself. Totally agree that we're supposed to find sympathy with Blanche, but I guess the question becomes, to what extent is she victimized by society and Stanley, and to what extent is she the author of her own pathology?
Yeah.
These are the kind of questions that one leaves the play still asking, and I don't think that they'll ever be satisfactorily answered. But, you know, the Kazan did see Blanche as the key to the production, and that's why he was really concerned when Brando was just taking over the performance in on Broadway.
It's interesting. In recent years, I've seen productions where you're almost not conscious that Stanley's around, except when he's around, because Blanche is played she's so foremost in the production. Cate Blanchett did a production of it here in Washington, and then later in New York, I think, that was kind of glorious in the way she played her. I think there was no question that she was playing Blanche as a crazy lady.
Yeah.
She was just sort of out there from the beginning. It was the power in the production, not Stanley. In fact, I can't even tell you who played Stanley. I don't remember.
Yeah. Let me play another moment from the film. This is Carl Malden, who plays Mitch, and Vivian Leigh, who plays Blanche. And this gets to a theme in the play, Robert Bray, about the question of imagination versus reality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say something about that before we play this moment?
Williams' most compelling characters are those who really exhibit an extraordinary power of the imagination. And, of course, the imagination is a compensation, usually, for their circumstances in which they find themselves. His survivors are people who really lack imagination. They're like Stella. They plod on. They are the survivors, yes, but they're not as interesting as sort of the defeated characters, such as Blanche. Vivian Leigh, when she was playing this part, she said, "I had 9 months in the theater with Blanche, and now she's in command of me."
Right.
She said that playing, this is a direct quote, she said that playing Blanche in the film, quote, tipped me over into madness.
Literally, right?
Literally. She was bipolar. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Brando said, you know, towards the end of the film, that Lee was beginning to dissolve mentally. Of course, she won the Academy Award, but was not there to receive it.
Here's a moment. This is Mitch, played by Carl Malden, as I mentioned. We hear Vivian Leigh, who's Blanche DuBois. Mitch is confronting Blanche, who has been lying to him. Here's this moment from A Streetcar Named Desire.
It's dark in here.
I like the dark. The dark is comforting to me.
I've never seen you in the light. That's a fact.
I've
never seen you in the afternoon.
I met you at the plan in the afternoon.
Not on Sunday afternoon. You never want to go out till after 6, and then it's always someplace that's not lighted much.
There's some obscure meaning in this, but I fail to catch.
What it means is I've never had a real good look at you, Blanche. Let's turn the light on in here.
Which light? What for?
This one here with this paper thing on it.
What did you want to do that for?
So that I can take a look at you, good and plain.
Of course, you don't really mean to be insulting.
No, just realistic.
I don't want realism. I want magic.
Magic.
Yes, yes, magic. I try to give that to people. I do misrepresent things. I don't tell truth. I tell what ought to be truth. And if that is sinful, then let me be punished for it. Don't turn the light on.
And of course he does. And it's a powerful moment. And we see Blanche straight on. Talk about this moment, because now she's sort of stripped of a pretense in some way, Robert Bray.
Well, I think one of the things we have to remember about Vivian Leigh's performance, and you know, of course, Brando did not win Best Actor. He lost out to Humphrey Bogart that year. But Vivian Leigh is an actress playing a part, but Blanche DuBois is also an playing a part, and she's playing the part of the Southern Belle. And I think sometimes when one of the things I tried to do in an article that I wrote recently was to emphasize this, that Vivian Leigh is slipping in and out of the part of the Southern aristocrat, right? It's a performance within a performance, and sometimes her acting in certain scenes is being viewed as over the top or too histrionic, but she's playing a part. Blanche is playing a part. So,
what do you think, finally, gentlemen? What's the legacy of this play? I mentioned earlier, you had spoken to us earlier, Bob Mondello, about the fact that you're glad people make different. They make a run at it, even though it's daunting to try to be Stanley Kowalski, given that Marlon Brando is on everyone's mind. But people keep making a run at it. I guess you think that's a good thing, of course.
I think it's a wonderful thing. Partly for my selfish reasons, that I'm a critic, and that if I'm going to go to plays, they should be always as good as Streetcar Named Desire, which ain't going to happen. But you know, in the same way that I've seen 36 Hamlets, I've probably seen 15 Streetcars, it's a play that keeps coming around and that I keep finding new things in. That production I mentioned earlier that was by an Eastern European director got a very different take on the circumstances of these characters, largely because it looked like it was being set in a dormitory in a gulag somewhere. Mm-hmm. It was just a you felt differently about the characters when they were stripped of the the trellises and the staircases and the things that you're used to seeing around them. So I think it's always useful to see characters in a new light and through new eyes. Different eras are going to see this play in different ways.
Robert Bray, anything to say finally about that?
Go see the play.
Well,
absolutely. Absolutely that.
Yeah. Robert Bray, co-author of the book Hollywood's Tennessee, founding editor emeritus of the Tennessee Williams Annual Review, joined us from a studio in Tennessee. Robert Bray, thanks to you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Bob Mondello, as always, thank you so much, Bob.
No, it's a joy. It really is.
Tonight at 7:30, the Grand Theater is premiering their production of A Streetcar Named Desire. The show will run through April 1st. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Tennessee Williams' classic play, A Streetcar Named Desire, because a production of it is opening this weekend. In fact, tonight, I should say. It opens tonight, runs through April 1st at the Grand Theater. Mark Fossen is directing the production of A Streetcar Named Desire. He's joining us here in the studio now. And Mark, welcome to you.
Thank you.
April Fossen plays Blanche DuBois. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
Are you nervous?
A little bit.
We'll talk about that in a moment. Robert Scott Smith is also with us. He plays Stanley Kowalski. Welcome to you.
Hi.
I have to begin with, because you were in another room while we were talking to Bob Mondello and Robert Bray, and the question of whether or not you want to, I don't know if you guys have seen the film, and whether you want to hear Vivian Leigh doing Blanche or Brando doing Stanley. As you're preparing for this show yourself, how are you thinking about that?
I have seen the film, but it's been decades, so I don't really have a good memory of it. But I, you know, I did just listen to her, and that's okay. It's
didn't ruin anything.
No,
huh?
I don't. I mean, you know, you're in what we're doing, and I just stay in there and don't think about what anybody else has done.
But it's so iconic.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? You just forget about that. I think what you said, I do what I'm doing. What? I focus on my process.
Yeah.
And I'm
I mean,
okay.
Of course it's a thing.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
It just occurred to me last night because we had audience members for the first time, just a few of them. But you can't help but realize that they have expectations. They expect somebody that they've seen play Blanche before, whether it was Vivian Leigh or Cate Blanchett or Gillian Anderson or, you know, this host of women who've played the role. But, you know, we're taking away their expectations pretty much from the get-go.
Yep.
I don't come in a floppy hat.
Yep.
So
yep.
If that's what you were expecting.
Here's something different.
Yeah.
Scott, what about you? How are you thinking about it?
I'm not as familiar with the film. I'm familiar with clips, you know, and certain things. Of course, the infamous Stella.
Yeah.
But what's, for me, it's I don't see it as iconic in the sense of it's intimidating. I just see it as someone who changed the game and how actors approach the work.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't look at it as, oh, I've got to be better, repeat, duplicate, or do a completely different take than what Marlon Brando did. I just need to play the role that Tennessee Williams wrote, because
right?
He wrote a very iconic character who has a lot of tactics, skills. There's a personality. There's a deep, interesting character to portray. And that's how I look at it.
Mark, how do you look at it?
Yeah, I think it's much of what Scott was talking about. Anytime you sort of look at an iconic film like that, the trap can be, I want to do what Brando did, or I want to not do what Brando did. And the best thing is just to ignore it completely and start from scratch. And that's what we try and do with these, is just take the play and ignore every other production that there's ever been.
Stanley, Animal Joy is how Tennessee Williams describes him in the play itself. And I mentioned this quote earlier in the show about the center of his life is pleasure with women, taking and giving. How are you thinking about the Stanley role in terms of that way? Are you thinking predatory? Are you thinking gentle, animal? I mean, is there some physical image you have in your mind too?
I've just kind of approached him. I tend to, personally as a human, I exist in a world of not wanting to take up space or make noise. So I feel I'm a little more delicate in how I approach things. But with Stanley, I've kind of had to really drop that and make noise and just allow myself to act as though I'm an animal in a cage and items are for me to grab or to consume or to use to get something I want. And it's very somewhat basic in its approach. I don't really think deep. I just think, okay, I need that. How do I get it? You know, I'm trying to just really be basic in that approach.
That's Stanley, though, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't think about things. He just reacts.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about Blanche? How are you thinking about the way she's described? Here's the thing for me, the question that I always wonder about for Blanche, as I'm seeing her and as I'm imagining you now think about who she is. Mm-hmm. Is she just crazy? Is she going crazy? Is she a pathological liar? Has society done something to her? Or is this just her own inability to take responsibility for who she is? I mean, how are you thinking about that? Or is it all of those things?
I think it's a little bit of all of them. I don't think she's – I wouldn't call her crazy, mainly because I don't think that's a very useful term. It just right. ends up being this generalized nothing.
Yeah.
I think she's certainly a pathological liar. I think she's probably an alcoholic. I think she – could definitely use some help from a mental health professional, which I think she's on her way to at the end of the play. And it's partially because of her circumstances. Her husband killed himself when they were first married, which was when she was like 16 years old. And then she's been in charge of this plantation and watched all of her extended family members die, some of them horribly. So it's a pretty hard way to live. And she's tried to sort of come out of that with some sense of
dignity.
Yes.
Yeah.
And trying to hold on to that has put her in a place of becoming a pathological liar and driving herself crazy in the attempt, I think.
Mark, talk a little bit about, as you're working through the characters with Scott and April, what have you encountered that's been difficult, or what are you having to work through?
Some of it is, especially working with Blanche, there is this, you want to avoid sort of the high histrionics. But that's also part of the character. She is playing the role of a Southern Belle. She is playing Scarlett O'Hara in a certain way, which is why I think it's so great that Vivian Leigh played
it
in the movie.
It's weird, yeah.
Because Blanche is sort of consciously trying to take on that role, and she is an actress at times. But a lot of it really becomes about when we get in the rehearsal room, the whole iconic nature of Streetcar disappears, and it's just about when are you going to pick up this glass and when are you going to pour whiskey in which bottle and which plate are you going to smash, and figuring out things like that, just real moment-to-moment reality, which is good because I think it kind of grounds us.
I want to play a scene from the production. This is Robert Scott Smith as Stanley and April Fossen as Blanche. Mark, you want to set this up for us? This is the first time they meet, Blanche and Stanley. She's arrived. He doesn't know she's supposed to be there. Talk about this scene, this moment, if you will.
Yeah, this is pretty early in the play, and already we've had some of Blanche's secrets have come to light. And Stanley's just been right now with Stella sort of plowing through Blanche's things as Blanche comes in, because there's the issue of what happened to this estate and where the money's gone.
May I have a drag on your cig?
Here, have one for yourself.
Well, thanks. It looks like my trunk has exploded.
Me and Stella were helping you unpack.
Well, you certainly did a fast and thorough job of it.
It looks like you raided some stylish shops in Paris.
Yes, clothes are my passion.
What does it cost for a string of fur pieces like that?
Well, those were a tribute from an admirer of mine.
He must have had a lot of admiration.
In my youth, I excited some admiration. But look at me now. Would you think it possible that I was ever considered to be attractive?
Your looks are okay.
I was fishing for a compliment, Stanley.
I don't go in for that stuff.
What stuff?
Compliments to women about their looks. I never met a woman that didn't know if she was good-looking or not without being told. And some of them give themselves credit for more than they've got. I once went out with this dame who said to me, "I am the glamorous type. I am the glamorous type." I said, "So what?"
And what did she say then?
She didn't say nothing. That shut her up like a clam.
Did it end the romance?
It ended the conversation. That's all. Some men are took in by this Hollywood glamour stuff, and some men are not.
I'm sure you belong in the second category.
That's right.
I cannot imagine any witch of a woman casting a spell over you.
That's right.
You're simple, straightforward, and honest. A bit on the primitive side, I should think. To interest you, a woman would have to
lay her cards on the table.
Well, I never cared for wishy-washy people. That was why when you walked in here last night, I said to myself, my sister has married a man.
There's a For those who know The Glass Menagerie, this is also a Tennessee Williams play. It's another. I can't tell which is the masterpiece for Tennessee Williams.
I might be changing my mind on that right now.
What do you mean? Because I should say that because you've directed Menagerie before. Yeah.
But the more that I work on Streetcar, the more of a masterpiece it becomes. Okay. It is so perfectly constructed.
Yeah. But there's a theme that they both share, and probably more than a few. And it's this, I'm not sure how you identify it, Mark, but the sensitive individual in the cruel, uncaring world.
Yeah, to a great extent, Blanche is another draft of Amanda.
Or
both of them, yeah, Amanda or Laura. And I think it is that sense that Tennessee felt himself of being a delicate, poetic soul trapped in a modern urban world that was changing out from under him. That genteel southern life is starting to disappear and fall into disrepair, and now the South is becoming places like New Orleans that are more urban. And I think that runs through quite a lot of his plays, which doesn't necessarily mean I don't think that Blanche is this blameless, poetic, beautiful soul that Tennessee completely identifies with.
Yeah.
He can see both sides of it.
What do you know about his sister Rose? She was an influence, I think, for a lot of these characters, these fragile characters.
Yeah, there is. And she was she was schizophrenic and had mental issues and was taken off for a lobotomy. But it was something that haunted Tennessee forever. In fact, at one point, I was just reading a biography of him, and he describes going up to Rose at one point and saying, "You disgust me. Stop doing what you're doing." And that phrase haunted him for the rest of his life, and it actually appears in Streetcar Named Desire, set in a completely different context. But once I realized that he had said that to Rose and what it meant to him, things open up. Yeah.
Because I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah.
You disgust me is something that is said.
Yes.
And has a terrible consequence.
And has a terrible consequence, and that comes straight out of Tennessee's life. He was always a very autobiographical writer in so many ways. And this idea of mental health and mental illness, I think, is something he comes back to so often. I think it's because of Rose.
Where does he get Stanley? Do you know?
He had spent a lot of time in New Orleans. I mean, I think that he knew these people. He knew this crowd. But I think that in some ways, Stanley is just so beautifully written as a counterpoint. They are just such polar opposites in class, in sexual behavior, everything about them, even in their dialect. They are opposing forces. And I tend to think that Stanley was created somewhat as the anti-Blanche.
Hmm. Scott, I wanted to ask you, and April, you too, about the writing. It's been said that Brando sort of changed the game with this play in many ways, and then the film. But it really comes back to the writing. What is it about the writing that seems so real or so organic? What have you noticed as you're preparing the role?
I remember when I was in grad school, we used a lot of the material from Streetcar for scene work because Tennessee Williams had such a gift of giving very clear objective work of what each character wants from the other. And it's opposing, and then there's tactics. Hmm. And the nice thing about Tennessee Williams is there's such a variety of tactics within the way he phrased or used the language. So it was a very clear tool to try to affect change in one another. And it just is a gift for an actor to be active, to actually do something. So yeah, I don't have to be caught up in an emotion or a state of being or a type. I can just go for something that I want and something's in my way of getting it. And so for me, that's where it translates in how he writes. And it's beautiful, beautiful language.
Yeah, it is.
It's also just the writing is incredibly smart and clever. And there's things that we only notice as we go along. You know, you'll be weeks into the process and go, oh my gosh, of course, this thing that I say right now connects back to all of these other things. And he's just so smart.
We have time, barely, but time for one more scene. Mark, will you set this other moment up for us? This is another, I think of it as a kind of an iconic moment. But this gives us this, things are building in their relationship, and they come to a head.
Yeah, this is right near the end of the play. It's actually just after that scene that we heard between Blanche and Mitch, played by Carl Malden, when that relationship has gone south. But then Stanley comes home and Blanche announces that she's just gotten a telegram from an old beau of hers who's a Texas oil millionaire who's going to whisk her away from all this. And she starts talking about what she can provide this billionaire as sort of a woman of refinement to be with him. And then Stanley takes it from there.
How strange that I should be called a destitute woman when I have all of these treasures locked in my heart. I think of myself as a very, very rich woman, but I have been foolish, casting my pearls before...
Swine, huh?
Yes, swine. Swine. And I'm thinking not only of you, but of your friend, Mr. Mitchell. He came to see me tonight. He dared to come here in his work clothes and repeat slander to me, vicious stories that he had gotten from you. I gave him his walking papers.
You did, huh?
But then he came back. He returned with a box of roses to beg my forgiveness. He implored my forgiveness. But some things are not forgivable. Deliberate cruelty is not forgivable. It is the one unforgivable thing, in my opinion. And it is the one thing of which I have never, never been guilty. And so I told him, I said to him, "Thank you. But it was foolish of me to think that we could ever adapt ourselves to each other. Our ways of life are too different. Our attitudes and our backgrounds are incompatible. We have to be realistic about such things. So, farewell, my friend, and let there be no hard feeling."
Was this before or after the telegram came from Texas?
What telegram? No, after. As a matter of fact,
there wasn't no wire at all.
Oh.
There isn't no millionaire, and Mitch didn't come back here with no roses because I know where he is.
Oh.
There isn't a damn thing but imagination and lies and conceit and tricks. And look at yourself. Take a look at yourself in that worn-out Mardi Gras outfit rented for 50 cents from some rag picker. And with that crazy crown on, what kind of queen do you think you are?
Oh, God.
I've been on to you from the start. Not once did you pull any wool over this boy's eyes. You come in here and sprinkle the place with powder and spray perfume and cover the light bulb with a paper lantern, and lo and behold, the place is turned into Egypt and you are Queen of the Nile, sitting on your throne and swilling down my liquor. I say, ha. Ha. Do you hear me? Ha, ha, ha.
Robert Scott Smith. He plays Stanley Kowalski. April Fossen there plays Blanche DuBois. Mark Fossen directs the play. It's the Grand Theater's production of A Streetcar Named Desire, which opens tonight. It runs through April 1st. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Break legs.
Thanks
you
so
guys.
Much.
Good luck. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.